Good evening.
Good evening.
You can say it back. Good evening.
Good evening.
There we go. So glad that you are here. We're going to be talking this weekend about enriching values and strengthening relationships. I'd like to ask you to, unless I refer you to the booklet, to kind of set it aside. You don't have to really take notes. This is going to be something you'll have for reference. But in the meantime, I really appreciate the eye contact and us staying together throughout both these sessions. I want to begin with a very simple question. How many of you have heard people in the world and also even among brethren, when they talk about marriage, talk about the marriage contract? Let me see your hands. You guys hear people talk about it in that way? I hear that all the time. And I want you to be very careful about falling into that secular trap, because marriage should not be thought of as simply a two-way contract. Whenever the Bible talks about marriage in this connection, it refers to it as a, covenant. Marriage is a spiritual covenant. Let me give you a couple of examples. For example, in Malachi 2, in verse 14, she is thy companion and the wife of thy covenant. And in Proverbs 2, 16 and 17, Solomon warns, deliver thee from the strange woman that forsaketh the friend of her youth, a reference to her husband, and forgets the covenant of her God. What exactly is a covenant? Well, according to Vine's Dictionary of Old Testament Words, the Hebrew word is in the sense of cutting. It is a compact made by passing between pieces of flesh. The verb form, berith, is found 280 times in the Old Testament, 260 times in the King James Version is translated covenant. And the verb form literally is to cut a covenant. And it actually goes back to the Abrahamic covenant and how it was initially established and ordained between God and Abraham in a sacrificial ceremony in Genesis chapter 15. Listen carefully to the text. And it came to pass that the sun went down, that it was dark, and behold, there was a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between the pieces. In the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram. If I understand this correctly, there is a dismembering of the sacrifice, and Abram would have walked between the pieces of the sacrifice, and then they would take the dismembered portions and put it together up on the altar, and there would be a solemn ceremony in the presence of God. This is something that would have been a context of worship, as you are offering these up as sweet savor unto God. And there is this commitment that God made to Abram and that Abram made with God. The idea of a covenant in the Old Testament was the relationship of love and loyalty between the Lord and His chosen people. And that's exactly what we find is involved in marriage. There is a solemn ceremony in the presence of God. There is an exchanging of vows of these two individuals who are exchanging love and loyalty, who have chosen each other. Our forefathers, when they put together the traditions that are now associated with wedding ceremonies, understood that marriage was a covenant. And the typical wedding that we are involved in today still has most of these traditions as a part of the ceremony. Only unfortunately, in our secular society, the spiritual covenantal ideas associated with it have pretty much been forgotten and dropped. I understand why our secular society would do that, but I don't want us as God's people to misunderstand what the original intent of these wedding traditions truly was. We need to keep these with us. And so let me go through some of these traditions, symbolism of the covenant in the wedding ceremony, many of which go back several thousand years. Most of them having been put together at least several hundred years ago. Do you ever think it's a little strange that when you walk into typically a church assembly or a wedding is taking place, that the first question the usher asks you is, whose side are you on? I think that's a rather strange way to be talked to as you enter into a wedding. But what they're doing is they're saying there were invitations sent out by the groom and the groom's family, and there are invitations sent out by the bride and her family. And typically you have the bride's invitations and their guests sit on one side and the groom sit on the other. And why is it that you almost always in a wedding have a center aisle? Why is that so important? And everyone waits for the song, Here Comes the Bride, so everyone can stand up and honor the bride as she walks down the center aisle between these honored guests that have usually been invited to this sacred ceremony with a very nice and formal invitation. And the parents and the grandparents have special seating as the ceremony begins. Well, originally, this was the covenant ceremony, that the guests are the living sacrifices, the individuals that had made such a contribution to both the bride and the groom. And of course, the ones who were most responsible for the bride and the groom getting to this point in their life is their parents and their grandparents. So they, as the living sacrifices, are literally a part of the wedding and the wedding ceremony. And then the center aisle is so you walk between the pieces as you come down to closer to the altar where you exchange your vows and you have a prayer before God. That's what that originally was supposed to represent, this covenant setting that goes back to Genesis chapter 15. And why is there typically a white runner that is put down the center aisle? Well, that's because this represents the fact that this is holy. This is sacred marriage. And you're getting closer and closer to the presence of God as you get closer and closer to the place where you will exchange your vows. And why is it typically that the groom enters first? Typically, when I'm involved in a wedding ceremony, there's a little door off to the side, say, and the preacher and the best man are hidden away, and then at the appropriate time, you walk out and you face the audience, the living sacrifices that have been invited, and everyone's waiting for the bride to appear. But the groom always comes out first. Why is that? Because the groom is to be the initiator of the covenant. Hopefully, he proposed to her and not the reverse. He is to be the leader of the home and this covenant ceremony. The word husband literally means house band. He is the one that is to band or to hold the family together through his spiritual leadership as he leads his home both here on the earth and ultimately, hopefully, is able to lead his family all the way to heaven. And how about the exchanging of the rings? For many years, I would say, are there rings? And someone would hand me one of the rings, and I'd hold it up, and I'd say, the rings are round, because they symbolize the never-ending love that you're to have for each other. And the rings are gold, and the engagement ring has a diamond on it. And these precious metals are supposed to remind us of the preciousness of their love in this relationship. All of that is true, and all of that is nice and poetic, but all of that is secondary to the fact that the rings are to be a token of the covenant, a public witness to everyone that these two people belong to each other, and everybody else, hands off. I mean, that's what the rings are supposed to remind everybody of. And whenever you have a covenant in the Bible, you usually also have a token of the covenant. The token or reminder of the Abrahamic covenant in the Old Testament was the ritual of circumcision. It was a token of the covenant. And when it comes to the promise that God would never again destroy the earth with a worldwide flood, the token of that promise was the rainbow. And every time we look at the rainbow, we're reminded of God's promise, which still exists even to this day. There's some other things we may want to think about in regards to the symbolism of the covenant or wedding ceremony. You'll notice that the father typically will walk the bride down the aisle. Well, why is that? And why is that so important? And typically, at a certain time, the preacher, the one that's presiding, will say, "Who giveth this woman away in marriage?" And, of course, typically the father will say, "Her mother and I do." Why the important role here of the father walking his daughter down the aisle? Well, in Deuteronomy chapter 22, 13 and 21, it is the father that has the responsibility to keep his daughter pure and to one day present his daughter as an untarnished gift to someone that he has approved of, basically to take over his responsibilities and now pass them on to the groom. Typically, the father is supposed to pilot, provide, and protect his family. In particular, his daughters. And yet, on the wedding day, there's going to be a change of relationship. It's a rite of passage. My youngest daughter, Allison, used to always wear these earrings, and they had engraved on them, "Daddy's little girl." For most of her life, I was the most important man in her life. She was Daddy's little girl. But once she gets married, that changes. Now her husband is to be the most important man in her life. Now he is the one that is primarily responsible to protect her and to pilot, to lead her. And I'm very pleased to say at that moment he now has a responsibility to provide for her. See, now he pays the bills, not me. I like that. That was a good rite of passage that occurred. But the point is that the father walks the bride down the aisle. And the bride is to wear a white dress. And that should be more than just a statement of fashion. It's supposed to represent her moral purity, her character, as the father presents his daughter to her groom. Furthermore, the father, as I mentioned, gives the bride away, which indicates the full blessing of the parents and the transfer of authority over to the groom. In the Bible, children are to obey their parents in the Lord, for this is right. And there's a sense in which that continues on, but there's actually a transfer of authority. The children are to be in submission to their father, but now they agree that they're going to be in submission to their new husband. And that's all pictured here as the father gives the bride away and transfers this authority. My personal favorite part of a wedding is when you get to turn the couple around and you say, "It is now my pleasure for the first time at any time to introduce to you Mr. and Mrs. And then in the case of my own wedding, it was Carlton Brent Hunter. And then everybody typically claps and then, you know, the good music goes on and they walk down the aisle. Why do you introduce the couple? Because this is establishing the change of names. I think it's important that we recognize that the wife is taking on the husband's name. It's a blending of the two families as they become one. And in the Abrahamic covenant, God changed Abram's name to Abraham. He goes from the exalted father to the exalted father of many nations. And his wife was named from names was changed as well. From Sarai to Sarah, she becomes the princess of many nations. This is so important that it brought about a permanent name change. And spiritually, of course, when we enter into a covenant relationship with the Father, and we go through the believer's wedding ceremony, often known as baptism, we come up out of that watery grave of baptism, and then we change our name. We become a Christian. And that becomes our primary identification from that point forward, that we belong to God and not just ourselves. And what about the signing of the guest book? This has always fascinated me. Typically, in order to make sure that people don't forget to sign it, now as you walk into typical weddings, they'll have it in the foyer and you sign it as you walk in. But for hundreds and hundreds of years, originally, the signing of the guest book was such that it was to be done after you witnessed the vows. Because you're signing the guest book as a signatory indicating that you were there and that you witnessed what this bride and groom had done. In fact, most weddings start off that we are gathered here together to witness this wedding in front of God and many witnesses. And these special guests come primarily to witness the vows and hopefully to do everything possible to keep this bride and groom true to their vows. So you have this support system of all of these different guests and friends and family members witnessing the vows, celebrating with the couple, and helping them to maintain faithfulness to those vows. How about the receiving line? For the longest time, I thought the purpose of the receiving line is so I would have a chance to kiss the bride. No. That's not it at all. The purpose of the receiving line was originally to give the couple a blessing. Originally, it was not so much about giving physical gifts, but giving spiritual advice and counsel as they begin their new life together. That's exactly what you find in the marriage of Ruth and Boaz, as they are receiving blessing after the wedding from each other. Pearls of wisdom, as it were. And why is there food at the reception? Well, this is the covenant celebration. Typically, after a covenant, and after the vows are exchanged, and you're both pleased and happy with the results, then the two families meet together and they share in a feast. Just like when we remember the covenant every Sunday that we have with the Lord, we maintain a sense of oneness as we gather and we partake of the unleavened bread and the fruit of the vine. That's the whole point, is because ultimately the most important covenant relationship we have is with the Lord. That, by the way, is a picture of my youngest daughter, Allison, and her husband, Brad, at their covenant celebration. Why feed the cake to each other? I thought the reason they did that was because it was a good photo shoot and it looked good in the album, and typically they'll get the cake over each other and everybody laughs and it's a nice moment. It's much more to it than just that. The idea of feeding the cake to each other in that particular way is important, because it's the idea of sealing the covenant and becoming one. What's mine is yours and yours is mine, just like we become one in the Lord's Supper. 1 Corinthians 11:24-25. Before we get into a discussion of the difference between a contract and a covenant, I want to go back to the point I made about the witnesses to the wedding are there, and they ought to serve as a support system to each other as much as possible. Do you know that the divorce rate in Armenia is about 0.4%? that amazing? It is almost unheard of. I was talking to somebody from Moldova, a little country on the Black Sea right next to Romania, and I was asking him about marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And he said, well, we don't have those issues in Moldova because divorce is pretty much doesn't happen. What? I mean, I could hardly believe that there are still cultures where that is the case. In the 17th and 1800s, that was pretty much the case here in the United States. At least divorce was very rare. Because people understood the nature of a covenant was that it was to be something that was in place until death do you part, not until divorce do you part. But I did some research, and this is what I found out is the tradition, for example, in Armenia. It is decided that at the wedding that there are godparents that are appointed to be mentors to help the couple if they ever get in trouble. And if the couple's ever arguing or having difficulties, then you're supposed to contact the godparents. And the godparents in that particular Armenian village would stop what they're doing immediately, and they would knock on the door of this couple, and they would say, we have heard that you are arguing a lot and having difficulties, and we're here to help you. And we have our bags with us because we're going to move in until we're sure that you're okay. And if for no other reason to regain your privacy, the couple learns how to resolve conflict better and works through their issues with this older couple's help. And then and only then do they go back to their home. That's how much they value supporting the couple and helping them through difficulties. And I think we would do well among the Lord's people to get back to that kind of closeness and support system early, not after Humpty Dumpty has already fallen off the wall. Okay, let's talk about the difference between a covenant and a contract. I think it's really important for us to realize that a marriage covenant, by its definition, is sacred. That's why the Bible says, what God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. It may take two to tango, as the saying goes, but it takes three to get married. In fact, I like to think of marriage as a holy triune, not a human duet. Literally, it's to be a love triangle, where the husband and wife love one another, but they also love God. And as they grow closer to God, they get closer to each other. And as they get closer to each other, hopefully they get closer to God. And hopefully over time, that triangle gets smaller and smaller as they become more and more intimate and more spiritual as they grow together. And I love this picture of Allison and Brad at their wedding praying together that God's blessing will be upon them in their marriage covenant. Sadly, many people do not take their wedding vows and their marriage covenant very seriously. Some people, almost on a whim, will decide to run off and get married, and there's a mad rush to the altar. Instead of enjoying and savoring the courtship, they oftentimes want to rush things and not really count the cost before they take these vows. Solomon said this, it is a snare to rashly say it is holy, and then later to make inquiry. I like what another translation said. It is a danger to a man to say without thought it is holy, and then after taking his vows to start questioning whether it is necessary to keep them. Another translator translated that verse this way, an impulsive vow is a trap. Later you wish you could get out of it. And so we need to make sure that we do everything possible to elevate marriage so that it is never anything that someone would go about on a whim. We often talk about the divorce rate, and for good reason. But one of the points of the research that I find to be just amazed at is that about 30% of all the divorces that occur in America each year occur in marriages that have only been in existence 24 months or less. Isn't that amazing? There's a huge amount of couples who bail very quickly in the first and second year. And it's certainly a sign of a crumbling society that we live in a country where the average marriage only lasts 8 years. According to the covenant marriage movement, this is their definition of a covenant. A covenant intended by God to be a lifelong, fruitful relationship between a man and a woman. Marriage is a vow to God, to each other, our families, and our community, to remain steadfast in unconditional love, reconciliation, and sexual purity while purposefully growing in our covenant marriage relationship. That certainly very well fits with God's plan and the biblical principles that we find within the scriptures. The Genesis account is especially rich with covenant language and concepts. It was in the Garden of Eden that the marriage covenant was first instituted. And of course, in Genesis 2, 24 and 25, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother, and shall be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." Now, when you look closely at that text, you will find that there are four key principles. And from this, I think you can derive four pillars that are absolutely necessary if we're going to have a successful marriage. This is what you can do if you're really interested in restoring the divine blueprint. So let's look at each of these four pillars in particular and see how each of them can be broken down into their component parts. The first pillar comes from Moses' statement that a man shall leave his father and mother. This is the pillar of severance, and it's very, very important. It's the breaking of the parent-child bond. It's a willingness to leave one's home in order to establish another. When I was a child, I used to hear a song about Billy Boy. "Billy Boy, Billy Boy, will you take her for a wife, Charming Billy?" And he talks about this woman that has all these amazing qualities. And at the end of the song, in the chorus, Billy says, "I'll not take for her to be a wife, though she's the joy of my life, because she's a young thing and cannot leave her mother." Some of you may remember that song. You know, that's a good reason not to take someone for a wife or a husband. They're not yet ready to cut the apron strings and leave their mother and father. I also want you to realize that Moses here was not just talking to Adam and Eve. This obviously has to be a blueprint for the covenant of marriage, which was being instituted here, because Adam and Eve had no family to leave. And so this is obviously talking about all marriages, and Jesus himself referred back to this in Matthew as the ultimate standard for marriage. And by the way, I was pondering this several years ago, and it dawned on me, this had to be a marriage made in heaven or in paradise, because this is the only marriage that I know of where there was no mother-in-law. Right? Because, well, you know. All right. Not that you can't have a great relationship with your mother-in-law, but did I waste that joke on you? It looks like I did. Okay. Anyway, so the first pillar is severance. The second pillar comes from the phrase that a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife. The NIV version says a man shall be united with his wife. The King James Version says a man shall cleave to his wife, which literally means to cling or to keep close. And Vine's Dictionary of New Testament Words talks about cleaving here as God is equivalent to cleaving to us as his covenant people. So, I take from this that the second pillar after severance is permanence. And I think it's quite interesting that the noun form of this word translated join or cleave is where we get the word glue. So you're to be glued literally to each other in the marriage. And we're not talking about Elmer's glue. We're talking about super glue. This is supposed to be something that is permanent. That's why Jesus said, what God hath joined together or glued together, let not man prematurely separate. A good friend of mine, Ralph Walker, made this statement that I like. He said, there are two things that you must never do to me prematurely. Embalm or divorce. He says, please do not attempt to embalm me before my time, nor sever the marriage bond before it is severed in God's timing by death. That's exactly right. Some things we just have to accept as a given. We may not like certain physical features we have, but that's just sort of the way we were born. Or we may not like the fact that we're mortal and that one of these days we're going to have to face death. But all of us have to face the fact that one of these days we are going to die. We are not meant to live here permanently. And it's a healthy sign if we can just accept our mortality and then teach us to number our days that we might have a heart of wisdom. I think we ought to view our marriages that way. Once we make the decision to get married, we just need to accept that, with rare exception, as just the way things are. Choose your love and love your choice and make the best of that relationship. The third pillar to a successful marriage is where he says that a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh. I think this has to do with unity. Certainly this has to do, in part, with consummating the marriage sexually. But I think more importantly is that Adam and Eve are in an environment here of emotional and physical nakedness, where they can be completely honest and trustworthy with one another. And I believe that it's critical for us to understand how that this idea of being one or being united with each other is a part of God's wonderful plan, where it's not that one and one equals two, but in this case, one and one can literally still be one. And covenant unity is not about just acting alike or having similar interests. But it involves a surrender, a blending of the wills. Because a key to a successful marriage is mutual goals. Someone has said, love is not so much spending hours looking into each other's eyes, nearly as it is learning to look in the same direction. And that's the way it is in a covenant marriage. In my own marriage, there were times where I would kind of argue with my wife, well, this is what I want. And she would say, well, this is what I want. And we'd sort of argue between each other about what each other wanted and then try to negotiate. But when we started saying, wait a minute, we belong to God, we're a Christian family, what does God want for our family? Then that just changed everything. And then you can work together as a couple and as a unit as you strive together to glorify God. I think this idea of God's unity was expressed just so eloquently in a piece of prose that I really, really like, just simply entitled Unity. Listen to this carefully. Man satisfies the woman, woman satisfies the man, and God blesses the union. Man plants the seed, woman bears the child, God gives the spirit. Man sets the discipline standards. Woman sets the love standards. God balances discipline with love. And I especially like this. Man is the breadwinner. Woman is the bread warmer. God is the bread provider. Man is woman's hero. Woman is man's cheerleader. God is the coach. Man learns as the woman's head. Woman follows as the man's body. God makes them become one flesh. Man presents a picture of Christ, woman presents a picture of the church, but God makes them joint heirs together. That's obviously exactly what God intended. And then sort of as a serendipity, you get this fourth pillar where he says they're both naked and not ashamed. This is the pillar of intimacy. I mean, why do you get married if not for love? I mean, people want to feel like they're married to their soulmate. And if you truly become one and you truly follow these principles that are laid out in the Garden of Eden, you can express your doubts and your insecurities, and you can do so knowing that you're going to be accepted, not laughed at. That other people may see you kind of cover things up and you may keep things private, but in front of your spouse, you are who you are. And if you are truly accepted for who you are in front of your spouse and know that you're still loved, it's just an amazing blessing and a sense of freedom. And that's what God wanted for a marriage covenant, where you truly can have a marriage made in heaven. I like to say that marriages today need more TV. And I don't mean television. I mean transparency and vulnerability. And that comes when you have the kind of trust that God designed in the marriage covenant. Best way to understand the distinction between a covenant and a contract, I think, is simply to contrast the two. A three-way divine covenant is, first of all, based upon trust. If you don't trust this person, please do not marry them. It's so important that we understand that having faith and trust in the other person is absolutely vital. A two-way human contract is based upon distrust. You both have your attorneys look at the documents and to look at the details and to, before you, you know, dot your I's and cross your T's, you want to make sure that your interests are being protected. I mean, the whole idea of a contract with legal counsel is I don't really trust this other person I'm doing this business deal with. That's the nature of a contract. The opposite should be true when you enter into a marriage covenant. And when it comes to a divine covenant, it's based upon unlimited responsibility. The traditional marriage vows reflect this when they talk about that I'm going to take this person for better or for worse, for in sickness and in health, for richer or poor. It's like, you know, I'm basically burning my bridges and jumping in feet first. There's this sense of trust and unlimited responsibilities that is the nature of a covenant. Consider how God stuck with the nation of Israel throughout unbelievable centuries of rebellion. And yet he never forgot them, though they so frequently forgot about him and the fact they were supposed to be different and special. It's a wonderful testimony of God's faithfulness even while Israel was unfaithful, as you read the Old Testament. And that's the way we should be in marriage as well, a sense of commitment to each other even when it's hard. On the other hand, when it comes to this and human contracts, typically the key is to limit your liability. In real estate, you'll often put down a small earnest deposit if you're not really serious and you think you may want to walk, because all you will lose is your deposit money. I guess you could sue for Pacific Performance, but it's rarely worth the effort. And most of the time, people understand whether someone's serious or not by how much skin they have in the game. The whole idea is limiting one's liability. While in marriage, you are giving yourselves totally to the other person. One of the things that I think is sad is how the marriage vows, in many cases, have been watered down. And it's so different from this idea of I'm going to take you for better, for worse, for richer, or poorer, in sickness and in health. I was at a wedding years ago. I could hardly believe it. But they came to the place where you normally would say something really meaningful. And the justice of the peace, it wasn't even a preacher, said that They would commit to one another that they would love each other as long as they made each other laugh. And there were some people in the audience that were kind of going, oh. And I'm back there going, are you kidding me? You're going to vow to stay with this person until their jokes get stale? You know, if you get tired of hearing the same joke over and over again, I'm out of here? What kind of a commitment is that? It's really no commitment at all. And very common today in modern wedding ceremonies is we're going to stay together as long as we love. In other words, if we feel like that we kind of fall out of love, the romantic love is gone, then again, I'm out of here. Again, no wonder the average marriage only lasts about 8 years. Good. Great. Feelings ebb and flow. There are going to be difficult times and bumps in the road in every marriage. And if people just kind of say, well, right now I'm not feeling it, so I'm out of here. That's just not at all what God intended, nor is it best for the family, our children, or our nation. Another very common expression I hear a lot that's probably better than the first two, but once you drill down, you realize it's really not at all what you should be thinking in marriage. And that is people who say, we will stay together as long as we meet each other's needs. You stop and think about it, that is saying, ironically, that this marriage is based upon a cost-benefit analysis, which they do in business all the time. In other words, as long as I think you're going to pull your weight and you're going to give me what I need, then I'm going to stay in this marriage. But if I selfishly ever think that I've got to pull more of the weight because maybe you're sick or you've got some problem, well, you can't count on me to help you work through that because I said I'd only stay with you as long as you met my needs. And so if my needs are not being met the way I think they ought to be, then I'm going to dump you, I'm going to divorce you, and find someone else that I think can give me a better deal. This is the exact opposite of what the Bible says marriage should be based upon. True love is selfless. A husband is supposed to love his wife even as Christ loved the church. He was willing to sacrifice to meet our needs on the cross. That is the biblical model for marriage. It's based upon agape love, which is selflessness, because you so care about and admire the other person, and it's not based upon selfishness and some sort of cost-benefit analysis. But that's what our modern society, Love American style, has done to the typical marriage relationship. As I alluded to already, a three-way divine covenant, by its very definition, should be lifelong and is not to be broken. While a two-way human contract can always just be avoided by one party or the other. It doesn't even have to be mutual consent. I mean, if Mo and I are together in some business and I say, you know, Mo, I don't really think this is working out. And he says, you know, Brent, I don't think it is either. Well, let's just rip up this agreement and go on. And we'll just depart amicably and be friends. So we talk today in our culture about an amicable divorce. Well, if you can amicably divorce, why don't you amicably, stay married? Just so ridiculous I can hardly say it, right? All right, so let's conclude with this thought. A contract says, I will take thee for me. A covenant says, I give myself to thee. A contract says, you had better do it. The covenant said, how may I serve you? A contract says, what do I get? A covenant says, what can I give? A contract says, I'll meet you halfway. A covenant says, I'll give you 100% plus. A contract says, I have to. A covenant says, I want to. We are living in a culture filled with broken vows, broken homes, and broken hearts. And I think it's time we do everything we can to stop all of these broken promises and broken homes and instead look to God and be determined to rediscover the divine blueprint for the marriage covenant. And we're going to look at how to do that more specifically in part two of our lesson. So what we'll do now is take a 10-minute break, have a song, and then we'll pick up here where we left off. Thank you so much for being here.